on maynard.com.au. Hey, you!
Yes, listeners, we're at the 40th anniversary of Triple J. 40 years ago, pretty much today, the radio station that was Triple J kicked off across the nation of Australia, creating havoc, doing strange things, and an awful lot of partying, of which will be reflected in what you hear tonight. We're going to meet a few of the people that were part of Triple J, a few people who were even a momentary at Triple J, and a lot of people that have listened to Triple J to see how it's changed over the years, why it's changed, who it's changed, and why is it still there?
40 years ago on Monday, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the staff party 40 years on. It's great to see so many fit Triple J employees still able to stand. Firstly, let me remind you that you have to pay for your drinks. Some people were shocked when they turned up and realised they had to pay for their drinks. It's a Triple J event, ladies and gentlemen. What were you expecting? Doing the heavy lifting with me tonight, none other than Zan Rowe. Zan Rowe.
And big shout outs to HG Nelson. Very excited and honoured to be celebrating 40 years of Double J and Triple J. And a note for the smokers in the room if you need to go for a ciggy.
And another reminder to the latecomers, you have to pay for the drinks. And I did notice, Zan, you stressed that those who feel the need to smoke something. And a Triple J crowd has always been known to smoke a lot of things. And here's some more Triple J music at this once in a 40 years happening. And now we can throw over to Mr. Tim Ritchie. Rip him, Ritchie.
Right about now, WA Quarters in full effect.
You are here at the major night we're having tonight, 40 years of Triple J, 40 years of a lot, and more than 40 years of Master Tom, as you might know him at the Hellfire Club, or Craig Janowski, a producer. What do you think of 40 years of Triple J? What's happening? Where are we? Why are we?
It's kind of a weird feeling. Like I realised that when I left Triple J, I'd spent a third of my life at the place and a third of the station's life at the place.
Look, what shows did you work on for our viewers?
Oh, God, the 5:30 Report, The Drum, Breakfast with Big Z, The Morning Show with Angela Caterns, The Morning Show with Jenny Aldershaw, The Morning Show with Sarah McDonald, The Ladies Lounge with Helen Razor and Judith Lucy.
I believe you were the referee for that show.
I needed body armour, believe me. That was my punishment. The Nippy Rock Shop with Rick Tanaka and the late Tony Barrell. The Works, and about 100 documentaries and a lot of other bits and pieces. Mm. Yeah.
And where do you think it sits in Australia's history? Do we still need a Triple J?
Oh, absolutely. There is nowhere else that actually gives a national reach for this kind of stuff, and there's nowhere else that actually can be bothered going to all of the country towns and regional centres that the Triple J goes to. One of the most fun things for me during my time at the network was the Unearth trips. And you'd go to Broken Hill or Gippsland or Launceston or some other relatively godforsaken place, and you'd realise when you'd meet the kids in the town that what a kind of cultural lifeline it was. The fact that, especially for all the misfits, the weirdos, the kids that didn't fit in, the ones that weren't part of the mainstream, that thought there was more than top 40, because mostly in those towns all there is top 40 radio or some hideous talk radio that's syndicated from Sydney with some right-wing shithead. Yeah, in those kind of towns, Triple J is really, really important. If you live in a city like Sydney or Melbourne, you can kind of go, what do we need it for anymore? But if you live in Broken Hill, you go, no, I know why we need it.
What's your best Triple J story, most outrageous story? I'm sure everyone's got one here tonight. What's one where you went, fuck, what's going on here?
Oh, I have so many of those, and so many I can't say probably, but maybe my farewell party, which we held in a lift at the ABC building in Ultimo. It's a very large lift, the one they use for moving grand pianos between floors. We set it up with sound system, lighting, crates and crates of champagne, a few thousand bulbs of nitrous oxide and dispensers and balloons, and an ounce of cocaine, and rode up and down in the lift for 3.5 hours until building management finally shut us down.
Now they would have called the SWAT team out and they would have shot you all.
It blew a lot of people's minds. It was kind of reliving the whole exploding head ethos all over again.
Have a great night here, Craig, and congratulations on 40 years.
It's a bit like a mutant high school reunion. And I was almost a little bit nervous before coming. I was kind of weird.
And like the high school reunion, there's a certain type of person that gets overly excited about a high school reunion, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm scared of them.
Thanks, Craig Donowski.
Will you hold my hand back later?
I certainly will.
Triple J.
Yeah!
We're here with Chris Norris, who is my breakfast producer on Triple J and was also a producer at Triple J for Yonks. In fact, when were you...
20 years.
20, and he's still at the ABC.
I know.
Unlike me, he's not been found out yet.
Yes.
What was it like working on not only my breakfast show, but that era of the changeover from going from a local Sydney station to a national network?
It was very exciting, Maynard. You brought a lot of energy to the role. It was really creative and fun in terms of breaking things in a new way, rather than just the old what's on in town tonight kind of thing. We were looking at brand new horizons about style, beauty, charm, love, happiness, and trying to put a smile on people's faces in the morning.
Inside Triple J, and even to this day, there's arguments about what should be played and what shouldn't be played, and they're very intense arguments, and they were going on back then. And of course, rap was rap, as it was being called. People hated rap, dance music, and then you had the indie music, and those people were against each other, weren't they, sometimes?
They were. There were large divisions. There always have been in music. Mm. And that's the beauty of it. It's the divisions that create the new inventions.
And have you got a story you can pull out from the breakfast show days that you might like to share with our audience here?
I remember going backstage with you to meet Princess Kylie Minogue one morning. And it was like 1 o'clock in the morning and we weren't going to get much sleep that day because we had to play that interview the next day.
And I remember that's when she was going out with Michael Hutchence.
That's right.
Ray Medhurst from the Rockmelons, I was a bit embarrassed about talking to them, and Ray pushed you and me into her, so we physically collided with her,
and we had to interview her.
Will Kylie be turning up tonight?
I wish. Could you make it happen for me, Maynard?
Hey, Maynard, it's Ray here from the Rockmelons. And I'm pleased to say that I never listen to your program because I'm never awake, and hopefully nobody else listens to it either.
Mr. Mikey Robbins is here. Mikey, how are you?
I'm good, Maynard. How are you, son?
Fellow Novocastrian, fellow Castanet Clubber, and fellow Triple J breakfast host. There's three things we share.
Thank you for interviewing me early in the night when things aren't so shabby.
Do you think there's a certain type of person here who enjoys a school reunion that's here that's going to go a bit crazy? Lampshade on the head stuff later.
All I've got two words. Jono, pantsless.
You think so?
No, I don't want to see it. But Jono will be pantsless.
What's one of your best stories from the breakfast years that you could share? Is there something that you went, I can't believe this is happening?
Watching Cheryl Kerno trying to pogo on stage when the Living End were doing Prison of Society at Brisbane University in front of 2,000 pogoing students. That was the wildest OB. I woke up in a park.
And when you were there, the playlists were coming in. Were you still allowed to put a few tracks of your own in back in that time?
Maynard, I never cared. Oh, I voted for Taylor Swift in the Hot 100. Actually, we used to sneak in tracks all the time. Mostly, after the top of the hour, we always finish off every hour with a Cruel Sea song. Because you could fade that out, because we could never fucking time out properly.
Ah, yes, of course. Tim Ritchie leading with Dead Eyes Opened here. Always a Severed Heads fan, always a supporter of Australian dance music. With me I have Jeff Overmyer, who still works for the ABC. And how long have you been with the ABC, and how long were you with Triple J?
With Triple J, it was just on 10 years, from 1984 to 1994.
And of course, you might not recognise Jeff's face or heard his voice, but he was the guy behind Live at the Wireless. You were one of the people who made that happen every week.
Yes, initially, yeah. It started in 83 with three bands, three locations, two studios, a live venue. Yeah, that was about mid-1983, and it's really great. The name, at least, Live at the Wireless, has continued.
What was one of the most favourite bands you ever recorded for Triple J that had the best story there? Was there a band that was just out of the box that really surprised you?
I think Warumpi Band was one. Pretty well did Live at the Wireless with them. That was in about 83, 84. They were pretty well at the top of their game. They were late turning up. They didn't want to do it. But when they fired up, and they were fantastic. And it's one of those ones you sit back and you go, ah, this is why I do this.
You've seen dozens and dozens of Triple J live concerts. You've done lots of OBs, outside broadcasts with them. What's one of the best stories you've got from one of the outside broadcasts with Triple J over the years?
There's been quite a lot. The Triple J Junior was always fun. There was a good story there when we were at Manly, and we'd camped out at Manly. Myself and John Diamond were camping there for the week, and it involved a portaloo being kicked over with a guy inside it. Not we didn't kick it over, his mates did. But the thing was, the portaloo was just so full, it went over on the door, and we had to push it back, and he just came body surfing out.
So this guy was like covered in poo and could have actually drowned in urine.
Oh, you're not wrong. He came out and he had toilet paper hanging off him, chased after his mates, but then it did leave a bit of a mess for the next few days that we had to be there. That was pretty awful.
And, of course, he didn't go running into the water like you would think you would do if you're at a beach and you're covered in poo.
No, he ran after his mates.
Yeah.
He was angry.
One of the things I have to ask you about, Jeff, because you were involved in this, is the Triple J quiz show, Rock Quiz, that was on 2 Triple J. Tell us, there's a bit of a story there, and because SBS don't actually, they weren't the first with it.
No, not with Rock Quiz. We had Rock Quiz. Rock Quiz started as a radio program in 1986 on Triple J. The brainchild initially of Stuart Matchett, myself, Chris Norris and John Diamond developed the idea, and we did 1986, as I said, with Stuart Matchett, 1987, a series with Rusty Nails. And it involved an audience member with a rock musician, two teams. We had crazy buzzer noises when they pressed their buzzer. It could be a guitar chord, it could be a trumpet blast. They had to guess songs, three songs mixed up, picking out what the riffs of songs were. But yeah, that was Rock Quiz, yeah, and that started in 1986 on Triple J. Unfortunately, I don't think too much of it survives. I'm not sure of a whole program surviving.
So it was actually their kind of first with the name and everything, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah, Rock Quiz, yeah, yep, yeah, yep, yeah, it was definitely first, and pretty much the concept.
I don't drink anymore.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Mr. Rusty Nails, a guy who doesn't drink anymore and certainly doesn't drink any less.
He was the
breakfast host on Double J. What years and how many? You were there until 1990, weren't you?
I was there until 1990 full-time, and then I used to do a live cross from London once a week to Dano, way back when, Dano's Drive programme.
Wow.
But the breakfast programme was 84 to 88. And then you...
No, it was Bigsy, then there
Bigsy,
was me.
Bigsy.
And what we need to tell people, and people don't believe this, and I'm glad I've got someone, that Triple J had a disco show that was on a Saturday night called The Number One Song in Heaven.
Tell us
about that.
Well, that's when I sort of first started at Double J in the mid-70s. I was there about year two. They wanted to do a disco show, but a disco show with a difference because, of course, Double J always did things differently. An indie band called Sparks had put out this disco track called The Number One Song in Heaven. So we used that as the theme. We used to do a lot of dub reggae and a lot of reggae, and it was enormous. We even had the Sex Pistols on there. They did a disco track, or rather... Excuse me, my plane's just landing. I must go. Sorry, I did tell him to circle until I was finished here, but you know how things are. We use every disco track, and you'd be surprised who actually came up with disco music in those days, and it was hugely popular.
And we talk about the musical arguments that go on at Triple J still now.
Yes.
Can you imagine what the musical argument would have been between supporters of punk music and people who liked dance music?
That's
back
right.
In 1978?
Oh, it was dreadful. Oh, it was like scratch your eyes out every Friday lunchtime meeting, you know. I had to stand and defend my corner that we were doing something new and radical, which we were for Australia. And that was the whole thing, and the whole idea of Double J and then Triple J was to push the boundaries of music, was to just push them out, knock them down, piss them off, and say, we're going to change Australian music one way or the other, and we don't care how we do it. And that's what we did. Don't start me on commercial radio. Commercial radio is not radio. It's something that fills the airwaves to sell advertising to satisfy shareholders. That is the beginning, and that is the end of it. They do not care about the artist or the music. They care about making a profit for their shareholders, and the less they can pay out to do... Oh, listen, I'm starting here. Triple J, Double J, 40 fucking years. Here's to the next 40, guys. You've got a big task ahead of you. Don't forget us. We were there.
Hello there, this is Dusty Springfield, and it's on some hideous hour of the morning in England, and I really resent Maynard calling me at this time of the morning. I've had 8 cups of coffee, and I feel really lousy. And I'm told he's a real Wally. And I tell you, I have to agree with that. I've only known him for 8 minutes, and he strikes me as being the biggest Wally I've ever known in my life. But anyway, you better listen to him because he plays good records.
I'm with Marius Webb now. Now, you're thinking, who's Marius Webb? Well, Marius is the guy who had to do all the Machiavellian machinations behind the scenes to get Double J on air and also helped a bit out with getting Triple J as a network. Am I right about that, Marius?
You are dead right, Maynard. You are the most accurate reporter I've spoken to in 10 minutes.
How did you convince a government to give money to a project, something like this? What was the main selling point?
Well, I didn't convince them. The government was Gough Whitlam, and Gough knew that young people needed more music. And so it was easy. They said, we want a new radio station. And they said to the ABC, here's the license. And the ABC asked me and Ron Moss to come up with an idea. And we did.
And once it was up and running, did they ever regret that decision?
Oh, a lot of people regretted it. The ABC management, the government. But we kept fighting. We just stayed on air. It was hard the first few years, you remember. It was very, very difficult sometimes, but we hung in there, and look at it today. It's a mega, mega network.
And what was the wildest thing that happened back in those early days where you were going, oh, man, this is just running off the rails?
Woo! Oh, well, there's no one wildest thing because they happened in succession. The first thing was a program we did called The Ins and Outs of Love, which was sex, sex, and more sex. And, boy, that caused a lot of trouble. A few years later, a Star Hotel in Newcastle. You know, I was there. I thought just to interview a couple of musicians. Guess what happened? In the first year, Holger Brockman was on air, and an Aboriginal guy, as activist, came in with a gun and said, "You're a hostage." And Holger went, "Ah!" And this guy read out a message and then said, "And thank you, and back to Holger." Because he, you know, I mean, it wasn't that serious. We pushed the boundaries a lot, and occasionally events overtook us.
Is it difficult to still make your case in 2015 for a network?
Not for me, but the others it is. It's very difficult. It's very hard in this sort of current climate. They don't need a lot of money, but they do need enough money to keep things going. Triple J, fortunately, is now the absolute darling child of the ABC. So they're not under any threat.
I think it's because most people in management aren't cool and they want to hang with the cool kids and get a bit of that halo effect.
They do, they do. The general manager of the ABC goes to all the Triple J Like a Virgin concerts.
They have a dress code and they rarely let him in.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't blame them. I wouldn't let him in either.
He listens from outside in the car park.
Management's got to be in its place.
Hi, this is David Hill, Managing Director of the ABC. Maynard, son, lift your game or you're out of here in 10 minutes.
I'm here with Andy Neil, the guy who probably doesn't want to admit it, but he's the guy who gave me the breakfast show job on Triple J.
I did, and I'm proud.
Yeah.
Happy to admit it.
Yeah. Andy, you covered the period from when it went to Triple J to being a network. How difficult was that behind the scenes to get the machinations going?
There's a lot of work in there because, you know, basically Triple J had... We expanded going national on the same budget as the Sydney station, so it meant bringing the rest of the ABC on board and getting a lot of resources out of ABC radio right around the country. There was a lot of hard work there.
I just spoke to Marius and I asked him what was the main selling point to get Double J going. What was the main selling point that got the politicians to want Triple J to be a national network? What's the one point that you... They went, yeah, you're right.
I think the politicians around the country... The kids in their electorates wanted Triple J. All they had was shit commercial radio, and there was all this fantastic music out there and a different take on news and current affairs that they weren't getting from the local commercial radio, and they weren't getting it from the straight ABC radio. So a lot of the politicians really were in favour of that. Even people like Tim Fisher from the National Party was pro-Triple J and wanted Triple J out to their electorates.
Okay, you're a radio station manager, you're a network manager, but you had to deal with ABC internal politics, the egos of presenters.
And
like yours. Massive, always a problem, always in Andy's office going, why can't I play more disco, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
How did you do that on a daily basis? Because it was pretty demanding and it weren't like you were on huge bucks either, like commercial managers are.
I just did it because I did out of commitment to trying to get great music out there, support Australian music, get a decent take on news and current affairs out there.
And of course,
because I loved it.
Because at that time, you were like the friction point between the station staff and the rest of the ABC as well. That was also your bit. So the staff might go, boo, Andy. And then the ABC management people would be going, boo, Andy, what are you doing? So it was a thankless job sometimes, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was hard. The staff would give you a hard time because you were management, and management would give you a hard time because you were too pro the staff. So,
what's one of the wildest things you witnessed or saw while you were at Triple J that you can share with us?
I think of some I can't share with you.
Oh, yeah. Everybody has them tonight, don't they, viewers?
Perhaps one of the wildest things was 2,000 people in the lower town hall of Sydney Town Hall when there was a protest about a few people. Tim Ritchie, Gail Austin and Tony Biggs didn't get their jobs back, and so there was a big protest about that, and there was 2,000 people yelling bullshit at me while I tried to talk and explain to them that Triple J hadn't gone commercial and I was trying to read out the playlist.
The fact that the love for the station was so much that people would bother to do that.
That's right.
That's the important thing.
That is the important thing.
And if they sacked Kyle and Jackie O, you wouldn't get people marching in the street about that. Well, you might, because they were happy.
They'd be celebrating, yeah.
They'd be celebrating, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that must have made you a little bit proud.
No, I certainly, all those people that marched in the street was because they cared about Triple J and they loved about Triple J. And they thought that it was going to go commercial, but it wasn't going to. So, and it didn't. And all of the, you know, heaps of great presenters and great journalists and great music and amazing Australian songs that Triple J's pumped out and supported over the last 40 years. Just fantastic.
Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad because I'm brown. And not the other colour, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority.
Who have we got here, and where do you fit into Triple J history?
Oh, God, 96 to 99, Jane Gazzo. I started out on weekend breakfast and then went to Super Request. In fact, it was me that coined the phrase because I thought Tunny had done Request Fest for so long, I figured it needed a change. So it was Super Request.
We talk about all the musical arguments. What was the big musical argument that went on at Triple J while you were there? What were the factions?
My favourite musical argument was usually with Arnold Frollos. He thought it would be hilarious 1 month to program Beatles and Stones. This is in the 90s and the Beatles and Stones weren't that cool, especially not to it. I was like 21 at the time and I thought, you can't program Beatles and Stones on bloody Super Request. People are going to turn up. But he was doing it as a joke and I didn't realise. So I'd ring up Sydney because I was in Melbourne at the time and have yelling fits at him and he'd be going, oh no, Jane, no, Jane, just settle down. But actually he was pissing himself because he was doing it as a joke. So that was pretty hilarious. You know what? I listen to Triple J now and I don't know what half the music is. I feel ancient now.
In fact, you're justified an ancient.
Oh, KLF. I think I heard you play the KLF. That was you. You got me into the KLF and you got me into Sultans of Ping.
Yep.
And you got me into You Got the Wrong Sinatra.
Jane,
you on radio now.
They're justified and they're ancient and they like to roam.
Dr. Carl, who I think you were actually broadcasting before there was Double J. You were probably out in William Street reading a science report before there was even a transmitter. You go back that far.
I go back to when there was not radio even invented, when Single J was just simply a guy with a loud voice shouting loudly in the backyard. Now, my very first appearance was 1975, when I went on to Double J to talk about my anti-gravity machine. And then there were one or two other bits and pieces in between. Then I reappeared in 1981 for the launch of the first space shuttle and then have been there ever since.
What made them think, hey, we really need this science reporter there? Because there was nothing like that going on radio at the time. Was that simply the reason?
Tony Barrell. Tony Barrell was a man of great insight and foresight. So he could be deep and yet see what would be a necessary trend. And at one stage, I got flicked off from Triple J by one of the managers who said, basically, we've discovered everything there is to know about science, so we don't need you anymore, fuck off.
Well, so you've been vindicated because people love science information. It's really come of age now.
It's always been there. It's basically answering curiosity because science is not a bunch of facts. Science is just simply a way to understand the world around us. And I'm very lucky to have been able to have a platform such as Double J, then Triple J, on which to expound that.
What has been the science fact that has blown your tiny mind and that of the listeners over all the years? There's so many in strange things.
There's two of them now.
Two of them, okay.
First one is that all the gold you'll ever see, such as the gold in my wedding ring, was manufactured, or this gold was manufactured inside a star as it exploded.
And we're not going to get any more.
And number two, you might think that the sun is a mighty beast, but the compost pile in my backyard, in terms of how much energy it generates per kilogram, is 40,000 times more powerful.
What?
Correct. Correct.
Wow.
So okay. The sun is very powerful, but it's very big and lazy. So at any given moment, there's only a few hundred hydrogen atoms undergoing fusion.
That's pretty amazing, Carl, and that's why he continues to be on the radio. What is the main major scientific advancement or discovery you think that's around the corner that is really going to trick your imagination next? Have you got an inkling?
In terms of what's going to affect people, I would say 3D printing. 3D printing is either the small scale where you've got a small box in your house where you can make a gun if you want to be crazy, or something that's the size of three warehouses, and Boeing has been using them to make metal parts for the inside of 25,000 jet engines. The environment inside a jet engine is truly hostile. Thousands, not hundreds of degrees centigrade, wind rushing past at several hundred kilometres per hour. And in the future, everybody will have a 3D printer at home in the same way everybody's got a computer. It'll be a box about the size of a microwave. It'll have 92 feedstocks, one for each element of the periodic table. And if you want to get a new smartphone, you pay a couple of hundred bucks and then start it going. In the morning there, it'll be inside your 3D printer and it'll have atoms of tantalum and titanium and silicon and copper and so forth. The 3D printer is going to revolutionise manufacturing.
Does that mean we'll also make food for us?
They've already used 3D printers to make food. You'll be able to make a violin, a vaccine, a stub axle for your car, a smartphone, a house, a car, and in fact another 3D printer.
But will you be able to manufacture love, Dr. Carl?
Love and life. Maybe quantum mechanics has the answer for those. We still don't know.
Dr. Carl Kuzinski, thank you for chatting to us.
Thank you, Dr. Maynard.
And with me I have Tim Ritchie, one of the prime movers of the dance in the early networking of Triple J, and a guy who's been DJing for longer than there's actually been dance music. When people were just knocking some rocks together, Tim was going, hey, I could get a tune out of that.
Thank you, Maynard. Yes, it's been a long time.
And when were you on Triple J from and to?
I started in 1976 and I finished in 1990, so 15 years.
And we've been talking about some of the arguments that went on at the station still now and did then about the musical styles. So you have furious arguments about rap music versus alternative rock and that sort of thing. What's one of the most interesting ones you've seen happen?
Well, it was definitely hip-hop. I was a New York correspondent for Triple J in 86. So I went to there, I was in New York, and I saw what was happening and it was big and it was going to be important. And I came back full of enthusiasm and they went, it's black, that doesn't fit. It's got beats that don't fit. Where's the pub rock? You can't play it. And of course I did play it and kept having fights off air and kept playing the music on air. I think I won because hip-hop is now part of Australian culture.
And over all the years, what's been the one killer track that's really even surprised you in how well it went? You were the guy, I think, who brought Grooves in the Heart by Delight into the station, if I'm not correct. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, but my job was to find lots of new music and I found lots. Don't believe the hype, Public Enemy.
Tim Ritchie, have a great time tonight and congratulations on being a part of Triple J history.
Thank you, Maynard.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
Well, that's a wrap here for the Triple J 40th party. As you can see, your tax dollars at work, although most people actually have to pay for their drinks tonight. We do have to reinforce that fact to you. Triple J, 40 years, long may she reign.
Triple J. Yeah!